Good afternoon. Calling State Affairs to order at 3:04 p.m. Thursday, March 18th, 2021, in the Max Grunberg Room of the Alaska Capitol. Present, from my left to right, Representatives Vance, Kaufman, Eastman, Story, Claimant, and myself, Chair Christ Tompkins. We have a quorum to conduct business of 6 members. Thanks to Tom with the LIO and Sophie with House Records for facilitating today's meeting. We have 2 items on the agenda. House Bill 118, expanding prisoner access to computers. It's a first hearing from my office. And then the second item on the agenda is a governor's bill, House Bill 103, relating to assisted living homes house rules, also a first hearing. Well, that bill will be presented by the Department of Health and Social Services. So to start off, we'll go to House Bill 118. And I want to present a little bit of contextual information for the benefit of the committee, although I know Representative Vance remembers this from sitting on the committee last legislature. We had a number of hearings relating to rehabilitation of convicted persons and how Alaska could improve its system within our correctional facilities and how we can reduce recidivism. And coming out of those hearings, there were a number of recommendations, in part from the Department of Corrections and other stakeholders that work to promote reentry of those who've served their time and to promote rehabilitation and reduce recidivism. And those statutory recommendations we put forward in, I think, was a committee bill, which had unanimous support of the committee last legislature, and it passed out of this committee with all due pass recommendations, and it also passed out of the House Judiciary Committee also with all due pass recommendations. And right around then, COVID hit, and the bill died in House rules, and so that was sort of where we left things off. So that is a little bit of the background. And so House Bill 118 before us today is identical to the letter to the bill that was in House Judiciary, that moved out of House Judiciary last year. So it's a little bit of a continuation of unfinished business, if you will, from the last legislature, but it all originated from this committee. And also let the record reflect that Representative Targoyne is at 3:06 p.m. So that's House Bill 118 and a little bit of the backstory. Here to sort of present the bill or refresh the committee on the contents of the bill is Lindsay Burke in my office. Ms. Burke, welcome. If you can come up, put yourself on record, and present an overview on the legislation. And congratulations on your first ever bill presentation.
Hi, I'm Lindsay Burke. I am staff for Representative Christ Tompkins. To go over the purpose of the bill and sponsor statement for the bill. So this bill provides 2 different things. It first would provide easier access for state identification for prisoners being released. This is something that's really important to reduce recidivism because it just provides for a better opportunity to reintegrate into society. It makes it easier so they are able to be directly sent the state IDs instead of being or sent a voucher, so that they would go to the DMV and pick up the state IDs. This just kind of alleviates that middleman so that they're able to have state IDs easier. The other portion is it would provide easier access to technology by allowing technical devices within cells for therapeutic, educational purposes, and job training. Job training has been shown as something that helps reduce recidivism And this would allow for easier access to training therapeutic purposes or therapy, and job training in general.
Thank you. I think that's sort of a higher level synopsis of the bill. We also have some invited testimony from Don Haybigger with Juno Reentry Coalition, and Marsha Oss with Fairbanks Reentry Coalition, and also available for questions is Kelly Good, Deputy Commissioner, Department of Corrections, who also has been very helpful in drafting the bill last legislature. So maybe we'll go to Mr. Haybigger. Please go ahead and put yourself on record and share your invited testimony.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman, and members of the House State Affairs Committee. For the record, my name is Don Haybigger, and I'm Coalition Coordinator for the Juno Reentry Coalition. Thank you for this opportunity to discuss improvements to our correctional system. A Reentry Coalition is a local organization that engages community partners, local businesses, and individuals to support those transitioning from corrections back into our communities. The purpose of Reentry Coalition is to ensure local resources are available that support successful reentry and reduces the incidence of reincarceration. When barriers to successful reentry manifest themselves, reentry coalitions work to alleviate those barriers. Reentry coalitions base their work on evidence-based principles and rely on the risk-need responsivity model. The Alaska Department of Corrections also utilizes this model through their level of service inventory revised assessment given to each inmate incarcerated more than 90 days. One thing the model teaches is that treatment benefits increase when interventions begin early in the corrections process. Reentry coalitions believe that Alaska has erected an artificial statutory barrier that adds difficulty to treatment delivery during incarceration. House Bill 118 addresses this issue by allowing access to technology to increase rehabilitative treatment, training, reentry case management, pro-social development, and related programming during incarceration. Early access to treatment utilizing safe and secure modern technology as the delivery medium improves community public safety outcomes as individuals are released better prepared for life on the outside. A pandemic has a way of highlighting reentry difficulties. Our reentry case managers report that the face-to-face pre-release planning, vitally important to reentry success, has ceased, and telephonic pre-release planning is hit or miss. Many reentrants meet their reentry case managers at the first time after release. Reentry coalitions think our state can do better, pandemic or not. HB 118 tackles the current statutory limitation on treatment access utilizing modern-day technology, and reentry coalitions support this change to current law. Second, the importance of having a valid state ID at release cannot be overstated. Simple things like accepting a job and filling in the I-9 cannot take place without one. HB 118 requires DMV and the Department of Corrections to work together to ensure an ID is in hand at release. Having an ID in hand at release means an improved reentry process as rebuilding one's life begins immediately. Currently, reentry case managers are reporting that reentrants have experienced initial time delays of a week or more while going through the DMV application process after release. Reentry coalitions support the state ID provision of HB 118. Thank you for the opportunity to address these issues with the committee. and Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, that concludes my comments.
Thank you very much, Mr. Haberger. I don't see Marsha Oss online, so we won't go to her, but I'm going to next go to Kelly Good with the Department of Corrections. And Ms. Good, I know you're available for questions, but if there's any sort of high-level comments you want to offer as far as House Bill 118, we would welcome them.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman. This is Kelly Good, Deputy Commissioner of Department of Corrections. Just for the record, the department does support the legislation before you, and thank you for your introduction. I think it's helpful maybe to know a little bit about the ID. Right now, about 12% of releasing inmates do not have a valid ID. And so, as your staff mentioned, those that release from the DOC that do not have a current ID in their hand will get a voucher, and they're using that voucher right now, as the former presenter said, going to DMV and going through that process. I can tell you on average, of the 12% that don't have an ID leaving the institution, about 100 of those people will use the voucher, and so that leaves another group of people. So to give you numbers, about 300 individuals released without ID, about another 100 of those folks right now use the voucher system. And so we are working with DMV, and we'll continue to do so, to find a way to bring an ID to close that gap so that almost everybody that's releasing from a facility has an ID in hand. Besides that, we do support the changes in the statutory requirement that doesn't allow right now an inmate to have a computer or technology device in their cell. And as your staff mentioned, it does allow us to provide education and also communication opportunities to inmates. And besides that, I'm here for questions.
Thank you very much, Deputy Commissioner Good. Questions from the committee? Representative Vance and then Representative Klingman.
Thank you for your testimony, and this is what that you just mentioned about the prisoners having a computer in their cell is the specific question that I had, because when we heard this bill last year, very supportive of expanding the alternatives, and that was pre-COVID. Now we see the need even more. But my understanding was that the computers would be in more of a controlled environment. Can you speak to the need to have a computer access in the cell in the individual cells?
And maybe we can, please proceed.
Through the chair, Representative Vance, I definitely understand your question. I think the issue here is just allowing the state to make to even allow them to have like a computerized system, and in this case we're using the term computer, but often what is available are tablets that provide this education and this communication link, and because all of our facilities are set up differently, the availability that if someone were needed to have one in the cell for a particular reason, maybe to make a family phone call or to do some sort of a course, right now state statute prohibits that. I do believe that, you know, when you look at the bigger picture and should the bill pass, become law, the department will write policy to make sure that these are used in a secure way, and that the inmates have access to them, but there are rules around that access. Yeah.
Follow up. One of the things that I'm thinking of is, wondering what your idea of what those rules would be, but also protecting the department against any liability that someone may say, hey, I believe it's a civil right for every inmate to have a tablet. We want to provide some kind of protection against that, because not that we want to limit access necessarily, but also it's a matter of money, it's a matter of security. You know, what are some of your thoughts on how we can protect ourselves legally in that manner?
Through the chair, Representative Vance, I would tell you that we would definitely work with the department law whenever we would build policy on this. So that would be my number one answer, is we would definitely work with the Department of Law. The other security issue that I'll just raise for the committee is this will not provide broad access to the Internet. It won't have free-flowing access to the Internet. We still have a constitutional obligation to protect victims' rights and others. So this is a controlled environment type of access. And we will make sure that that remains tight. So, but we will work with law and others to ensure that what we roll out is legal and fair for everyone.
Follow-up for Ms. Good?
Follow-up.
Thank you for answering those questions. And I have questions. During COVID, have the regulations been relaxed so that you can make use of the tablets for visitation and also telehealth, because I know that you've had to greatly restrict access. And could you tell us how that experience has gone for DOC and what you learned during the time of this new period of access through the Internet?
Yes, through the chair, Representative Vance, we wish we could have. Many times we have wanted to try to bring in tablets during this time. Unfortunately, with state law, the pandemic didn't allow us to, it's not in regulations, it's actually in statute. And so unfortunately we could not bring tablets in, although I can promise you we definitely wanted to when we had to restrict visitation. So telehealth, I know HARS did use that, but that was through their medical and not for an individual offender. And so telehealth was utilized there, but not in the tablet situation.
Follow up. So with this specific statute change, it would allow the department to utilize telehealth for members and home visitation? Or not home visitation, but visitation with loved ones?
Through the chair, Representative Vance. On the telehealth, I'd have to get back to you. I'm not exactly sure how far you're going. It will provide, it will provide what the department looks at. So there can be education. There can be some social programs on there. There can be visitation, ways to communicate with family members. As far as telehealth right now, those are, I would say, organized more through the education and the medical group. But if you'd like, I can look into what programs of telehealth are available in general for the inmate population, but I don't have that today.
All right, thank you for that. And a question for the maker of the bill, and I promise I'll be done, is why... I don't remember if this came in through judiciary last year, but why the use on page 6, line 26, the use of the word healthcare versus telehealth?
I think I can speak to that because that's language from last year. My recollection is we were incorporating language in partnership with the Department of Corrections. So I just think process-wise, that's my recollection. I might be wrong. Although, if in any way healthcare is proscriptive to the possibility of telehealth, and that's certainly not the intent, so it can be maybe an easy fix or amendment to make that explicitly clear and open.
Thank you.
Fully supportive of that for sure. Representative Kleeman.
Thank you. A couple of questions for Ms. Good. As I understand it, the portion of the bill on page 6, that's subsection I, that's the portion that without this change, that's what prohibits you from providing tablets or computers to prisoners under any circumstances. Is that your understanding as well?
Through the chair, Representative Clayman, that is a part of the statute now that we would like, yes, that we are pleased to have revised so that we can offer as much through the tablets as possible. So I think the idea really was to be more expansive. Therefore, we wouldn't get caught where we are today. I mean, I think when the bill was passed in the 90s, there probably wasn't a vision that tablets could be used in a secure manner for inmates within the prison walls is my guess. And so I think when the discussion was for this language, it was to be more expansive to where when things became available, such as telehealth, healthcare, different materials, that we would be allowed to offer it rather than prohibited.
Follow up?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In terms of protecting the public from prisoners in prison using computers or tablets for inappropriate purposes, do you have plans in mind in terms of how you'll be able to prevent that from the Department of Corrections standpoint?
Yes, through the chair, Representative Clayman, we will work with vendors. There are vendors across the nation that do this every day. They have secure networks. We would obviously work with them, with our IT people, to ensure that we have the proper security and placement in place for that to happen.
And then, and to the extent this is more a question for Ledge Legal, I can certainly refer to them, but I read the language on line 26 about healthcare is broad enough to include telehealth, but telehealth may not be broad enough to include all healthcare. So I think the use of healthcare is appropriate. But if you look up to lines 22 through 24, there's reference to rehabilitation, compliance with the reentry plan or case plan. Does the facilitating a case plan, does that somehow limit the ability to use tablets or telehealth? Or use tablets for health or telehealth purposes if it's just a prisoner that is sick and wants to talk to the doctor? Does that include the case plan that they should stay healthy while in prison, or is that something different from corrections perspective?
Through the chair, Representative Clayman, I want to make sure I'm following you, but I think what you're referring to is, in this case, it would be the reentry plan, the OMP that you're familiar with. It would be like access to that. I don't think we're being prohibitive here. I think we're being broader on what they possibly could have access to on a tablet.
Okay, but your understanding is this language would allow a prisoner in their cell to use a tablet to communicate with their medical provider by telehealth type means.
And through the chair, Representative Clayman, and this is, I want to get back to you on this, the same as Representative Vance. I want to make sure that we actually, I don't know that we have the full availability to go to a provider, and so I need to find that out. I know that we're talking about healthcare in general, learning about healthcare, and those types of programs, but actually having direct access to a provider, I want to clarify and make sure that that's something we would be able to provide, and I can get back to you on that.
Okay, and just for follow-up and
yeah.
For clarity, the reason that I ask is that if it's about if it's a reentry plan that says, you know, you'll stay physically fit, you'll eat well, you'll do good things so that you're going to be healthier, that seems like part of a reentry plan. But if somebody's actually getting treated in the department, I tend to think that is, if I've got a cold, you're not going to have me talk to the doctor from the cell. You're going to take me into the infirmary and get treatment within corrections. And to the extent that the medical providers and corrections can't provide the care, they probably have access today to talk directly with actual providers via telehealth from the infirmary with the prisoner. And so you may not have that limit. I guess it raises the question about what would one actually be doing for one's own health care in terms of communicating directly with a provider.
I know, I appreciate that, Representative Clayman. The other thing I would say is a lot of inmates may have special diets. Maybe that's something that is in their case plan that then they could view on a tablet, right? If they need to be reminded of what would be good for them, what they should maybe eat more of. Some have high fiber diets, let's just say. Another thing that may be used, and it could be covered under healthcare, is that they would be able to maybe fill out forms like your Medicaid forms and things like that they have to do. So those are all things we would try to get on the tablet. And I think having healthcare in the bill allows us growth. If we're too narrow, and that's just one thing I've mentioned earlier, but I think if we're too narrow, we may end up where we are today. And I think what we were trying to do is make sure we were expansive. And so as technology changes, we can offer things in a safe, secure manner to the inmates.
Thank you, Ms. Good. That's helpful. Other questions from the committee? Rep. Kaufman.
Thank you. Through the chair, I'm curious about the, this kind of a, maybe a nitpicking little thing, but wondering about the tablets being a hazard in terms of glass. I know, you know, breaking a cell phone glass. So do we have concerns with prisoners having a source of glass that might be turned into a weapon or for self-harm?
Through the chair, Representative, we will work with providers and vendors that have developed safe and secure ways to do the tablets. They've been proven in other facilities nationwide, and that would be something we would definitely be aware of, but we'll work with a provider that could that would offer those types of protection.
Follow up?
Please. Thank you. Through the chair, the other question I was wondering is, there's a Washington Post article that was in our pre-read, and it was talking about internet freedom, internet as a liberator, and it references the internet being used, devices being used to coordinate rebellion in the Arab Spring, New York and Ferguson, Missouri. I'm just wondering, will this system enable that type of cross-communication coordination between inmates, that they could possibly use this system being there against the guards that are responsible for keeping them secure?
Through the chair, Representative, this would not be a free-flowing internet access. This would be restricted access with security, and we would work with the vendors in order to get those sidebars very tight. It is also not only what you mentioned, but like I mentioned earlier, we have a constitutional obligation to protect victims as well. That, you know, we can't have offenders reaching out to victims without notice and things like that. So this would be building a secure network that we work with the vendor to ensure that we're meeting the needs of our institution and the safety of the public.
Follow up.
Thank you. Through the chair, I guess that some of these questions about, you know, the glass in the cell, you know, other control issues, I'll just call it, is it really better to allow in-cell use than a more curated type library access, something a little bit more out where it can be monitored physically? Thank you.
Through the chair, Representative, no, you may be right. In some of our institutions, that may be the exact way that it would be set up, is more in a checkout, use it in a general area where there are people around. I just don't want to say that it would never be used within a single cell, depending on an individual needs and circumstances. So, but in general, yeah, I do understand what you're saying, and I think that's what policy and the department would look at depending on the different facilities.
Short follow-up, Rep. Kaufman.
Thank you. Through the chair. Yeah, I'm thinking kind of like how a lot of good parents won't let a kid, you know, use a computer in their bedroom, and I'm just picturing sort of a similar thing. Not that they're kids, but, again, there's a control issue. Thank you very much.
I just add a comment that, broadly on the access question, this just sort of provides statutory parameters, but, DOC is, they're professionals and they do this work every day, every year. So I imagine, you know, as Deputy Commissioner Good has testified, there'll be very sort of narrow and sort of prescribed sidebars, and they're just looking for the statutory discretion to do what they presently cannot do, also drawing on experience from other states around the country. So just to connect some dots, that's a thought. Representative Eastman?
Thank you. I am looking at page 4 of the bill, and I just have a question about how the bill is currently constructed. In section 11, where the changes are, it seems to say that the commissioner shall assist a prisoner with obtaining a valid state identification card. And then the language we're adding seems to be saying a lot of the same thing. Again, the commissioner is going to make a good faith effort to ensure the prisoner has a state identification card. And that seems to be a little bit repetitious, and I'm not exactly sure why we're saying it twice. And I see that we're emphasizing 120 days, but if the requirement's already that the commissioner is going to be assisting any prisoner, even say a 119-day prisoner, with identifying and getting them an ID card, why are we making this distinction and yet saying the same thing two different ways?
Ms. Burke or Deputy Commissioner Good, any comment on that question? Deputy Commissioner, do you happen to remember from last legislature if there was a particular origin of that added language?
Mr. Chairman, this is Kelly. I don't, and I don't know if that was just a drafting determination.
And any comment, Ms. Burke?
I'm not certain of that either.
Okay. Well, maybe you could get back to the committee for why it was drafted in that manner, conferring with the drafters and the agency.
I can do that.
Good question. Thank you, Representative
Eastman. Oh, through the chair, Mr. Chairman?
Yes,
after
please.
After I read it again, what it could be saying, Representative Eastman, is it could be saying that in that first part that is not changed, we can continue to use the voucher system with somebody that may not have been with us for 120 days. But after 120 days, the legislature would like to work, DOC and DOA, to work together to get them an actual ID. I think that could have been the distinction.
Thank you. Representative Eastman?
Follow-up to that. So if there's a voucher that's going to be used in one situation and not the other, is there any reason why we wouldn't want to, as a legislature, simply instruct the commissioner to ensure that all inmates have an ID card upon release and just sort of make sure that emphasis is equal across the board, rather than we kind of seem to be emphasizing those after 120 days a little bit more so? I'm not really sure how those prisoners need to have an ID more than any other prisoner, I guess.
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, I think it's really about timing. As you know, when you go to the DMV these days, you get a temporary card, and the official card doesn't come for several weeks, and I think it's just that kind of a timing issue that was there and discussed last year, and therefore somebody that might be in for only, let's just say, you know, 4 or 5 days, we would not have the time in order to get them that new ID. And so I think maybe that's where this thought process came from.
Thank you. Another question?
Follow-up.
So I'm also looking in Section 5 of the bill, and I see that we are removing the instruction that we're providing to inmates on obtaining an ID. And I'm just wondering why we need to be removing that. It would seem to me that, you know, there might still be some value in making sure that that was addressed as part of the, you know, release training program, if nothing else, just to confirm that the process is working and that they have all the information about their ID that hopefully, if they haven't already received, they'll be coming. Can you comment on that, please?
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, I believe that was a drafting determination, if that is not one that I was made aware of.
Thank you very much.
Further questions from the committee? Rep Story.
Thank you, Chair Kreiss-Tompkins. And I definitely remember this bill from last year and also the experience many of the legislators had in going through the reentry assimilation that we did and what the experience was like to get released and to go through several barriers, as was pointed out early, to getting ID. And as we know, citizens who are incarcerated, 90% of them do reenter, and we want them to be as successful as possible. And so my concern is there's a zero fiscal note with this bill. And I just, I know when we talk about on page 6, section I, I'm trying to understand a little bit more about the education. So is the idea that citizens who are incarcerated can take classes, can participate in behavioral health sessions as the equipment allows, and do we have enough resources to make this realistic? I know we've talked about how limited we are in educational options, and I was hoping this would help, and I'm trying to get a picture of that and also the price tag. Thank you.
Deputy Commissioner?
Through the chair, Representative Story, thank you. This bill primarily is an authorization bill, right? It gives us the authority to add this technology as another way of providing this education. And we do believe, yes, we have the education. We have those programs. We would work with a vendor. And at this time, we are confident that the fiscal note in front of you is accurate, and we would build upon that. But first and foremost, we need the authority to even start the process.
Thank you.
Thank you. Rep. Eastman, and maybe we'll look to make a move after your question.
Thank you. Follow-up to that question. I'm just wondering, it seems to me from the language here in Section I that the department is basically asking for statutory approval to allow a inmate to use a computer for any purpose. And I'm just wondering the thought process behind that broad authority, or can you talk to that?
For clarification, Representative Eastman, can you point me in the right direction of any purpose? I'm sorry, I missed that.
Yes, so on page 6, again in Section I, and we're removing the language that says, you know, that the computer use by the inmate has to be limited to the above purposes, and now we're opening it up, and it seems like it ends up remaining open-ended to where if the department at any point wanted to add purposes, that they now have the ability to do so. I'm just wondering what the thought process is behind that request for that broad of authority.
Thank you. Through the chair, Representative Eastman. The idea behind removing that language was that was part of the language that was confining to us. As technology grows, as more services are available through some form of technology, such as a tablet. And so, again, we were trying not to box ourselves in. If the legislature chooses to put sidebars on there, of course, we understand that's a policy call on your part. But the way we were thinking of it is we just don't know what comes around in another year or two, and so this was giving us the ability to change with the time.
Thank you.
All right. Seeing no further questions from the committee, thank you very much, Deputy Commissioner Good, for your testimony. We'll bring this back before the committee, and my office may communicate an amendment deadline, sort of depending on where members are at, perhaps sometime next week. So that's House Bill 118. That takes us to the second item on today's agenda, House Bill 103. This is a first hearing and introduction, and at this time, John Lee, Director of Senior Disability Services, if you're with us, please put yourself on record and go ahead and present the legislation.
To the chair, this is Director John Lee. I am the Director of Senior Disability Services. Joining me today is Tony Newman, who's my Deputy Director, Lynn Kalman-Cruz, who's my Chief of Quality, and from Healthcare Services, joining us is Craig Baxter, who's over residential licensing. I just want to say thank you so much for allowing me the opportunity to present this bill. And before I go into the details about the bill, it might be useful to provide context about some of the terms that we'll be using and what this bill applies to. Some of the terms that we use are home and community-based settings, and our waiver programs, our 1915C waiver programs. And these programs exist to provide significantly lower cost home and community-based options for individuals with who qualify for either nursing home level of care or for institutional care called an intermediate care facility for individuals with developmental disabilities. And so the bill that's in front of us today addresses some issues that the federal government wants Alaska to correct. Federal government issued what's called the Home and Community-Based Services Final Rule, also known as the Code of Federal Regulations. So if I use Code of Federal regulation or final rules, it's the same thing. But the CMS issued this final rule a few years ago, and states have until 2023 to make the statutory changes required to be in compliance with these new settings requirements. And perspective, the reason for home and community-based waivers, the 1915C waivers, is to provide options for individuals who qualify for nursing home care or who have severe intellectual or developmental disabilities and qualify for an intermediate care facility to provide lower cost options to remain in their community, either in their home or in a home-like setting. And so we're talking about the home-like setting. So for context, the bill applies to our assisted living facility providers that are licensed as a provider of these services, and so that's what the bill is about, to correct what the federal government has put in their final rule that provides certain requirements, and I'll get right into that now. So why is this bill needed? Alaska statutes are not in compliance with federal regulation that require home and community-based service providers to give people who are on waivers the same access to community and people as those who are not on waivers. So we treat our people with disabilities or who require these type of services to be treated with the same respect that everyone is to be treated with. For example, state law that currently exists allows that an assisted living home may establish house rules that address residential rights to have visitors. While the state statute says rules may not be unusually restrictive, the federal regulation is more explicit. It states that individuals have the right to have visitors of their choice at the time of their choosing. And although Alaska received initial approval from the feds for its plan to bring our settings into compliance, the approval was contingent on the state revising its statute to reflect these federal requirements. And ongoing financial participation in the state waiver programs by the federal government is reliant on services being provided in a compliant setting. And without amending this, the state is in jeopardy of losing these programs. So what does the bill do to address these needs? The proposal is a simple insertion of language into the assisted living home statutes, Alaska Statute 4733, that will bring the state into compliance with CMS, or Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, home and community-based settings requirements, protecting Alaska's federal share of Medicaid payments for home and community-based waivers. The bill would ensure recipients of residential waiver services will be able to live under conditions that are as much like home as possible. And so who's going to be impacted? Alaska has approximately 700 assisted living homes who would be required to abide by these conditions defined in the bill. The new statutory language would afford all residents living in assisted living homes the same rights regardless of whether the home accepts Medicaid services or payment or not. And the vast majority of the homes are already compliant. Of those 700 homes, more than 650 are already compliant through participating in our Medicaid waiver programs. And so we're talking about a small subset of individual facilities that may or may not be in compliance. And so the statute change would require them to be in compliance with the federal law. And as I said earlier, the deadline for the state to adopt this statutory change is March of 2023. The initial deadline was extended due to the pandemic, so we do have some additional time, but the time is we would need to be compliant is March 2023. And with your permission, I could read the sectional analysis, or I simply stop and open this up for questions.
Let's go to questions with our remaining time, and it looks like we already have one from Rep. Vance.
Thank you. I have a question about who will be impacted with this bill. I appreciate your sectional and answering so many of the questions preemptively. I really appreciate a thorough packet. But will you be making communication when this bill passes? Will you be sending out a legal notice by mail, communication of some sort for these homes to be in compliance?
Through the chair, excellent question. The providers that are already certified through SDS are already in compliance, and we communicate to them through our SDS e-alerts and other methods. And I'll let Craig Baxter introduce himself and talk about how licensing will notify providers of this requirement. Craig?
It's Craig Baxter with Residential Licensing through the chair. Yes, we would notify all of these providers who are currently who currently don't have house rules that meet the setting standards that John talked about. We provide them with notice and give them a time period to come into compliance.
Follow up. And how much time would they have to come into compliance?
You would probably consider somewhere between 30 and 90 days to come into compliance and update those house rules. For something like this, that seems to be what we've done in the past. We'd probably consult with the Department of Law first. We wouldn't be heavy-handed in forcing facilities to update within a short period of time, and we give them ample time to compliance. So my guess would be somewhere between 30 and 90 days.
Follow up. I'm looking at some of the documents, the HCBS settings final rule, which is the 42 CFR page, and there's a highlighted section, individuals are able to have visitors of their choosing at any time. I'm just thinking about COVID. Does that still apply even through the COVID-related pandemic?
Through the chair, this is Director John Lee, Senior Disability Services. This bill really has nothing to do with the pandemic. This statute change, this bill was required with or without COVID. During the pandemic, through our flexibilities from the public health emergency at the national level, we've waived certain regulations, and this is one of them. And if Craig has anything else to add, I'd let him close out with some additional comments on this.
Mr. Baxter?
Yes, this is Craig Baxter to the chair. During COVID, based on CDC guidelines that come out through public health and certain flexibilities that John describes there, there have been limitations placed on visitation to protect the residents that are being served within the facilities. So this bill and the changes to the statute would essentially affect facilities outside the scope of the COVID pandemic. Once the COVID restrictions are no longer in place, the expectation for visitation would come into effect. The COVID restrictions, the guidelines that come out from DHSS allow for facilities to be restrictive with visitation in order to protect residents currently.
One more follow-up.
Last follow-up.
Is that based upon the federal emergency regulations or issued by the state? Because right now, it doesn't seem like the state and federal are exactly in alignment. And so I'm just curious on what the guidelines, what purview they're falling under.
Through the chair, this is John Lee, the Director of Senior Disability Services. The flexibilities that we have in the state of Alaska to manage during the pandemic for our waiver programs are contingent on the federal public health emergency. So from an SDS perspective, the regulations are waived because of the public health emergency. Craig, do you have any additional comments from your perspective?
This is Craig Baxter to the chair. No, I do not.
Thank you for that clarification.
Thank you. And maybe a last question. Rep. Klayman's hand is up first. Sorry, Rep. Eastman. And then out of respect to the DOA Finance Subcommittee, we'll wrap up and bring this bill back before the committee. Rep. Klayman.
Just following up on that last, since the public health emergency is no longer in place unless the legislature takes action, what's the impact of there being no declaration currently in place?
Through the chair, excellent question. Because our flexibilities are contingent on the federal public health emergency, whether or not the state extends its public health emergency or disaster declaration will have no impact on this bill.
Thank you. Mr. Lee, Mr. Baxter, thank you both for your testimony and answers, and thank you both, Mr. Newman and Kyle Mancruse for being available for questions, and we'll be in touch when we're able to schedule this bill next in the committee. Just a final reminder, no meeting this Saturday, but as you all may have seen, we will be meeting next Saturday, so we're sort of on a bi-weekly cadence at this point, similar to Mount Edgecombe High School, classes every other Saturday. And on next Tuesday, March 23rd, we have hopefully a final here on House Bill 44 from Rep. Thompson relating to accounting, and then also we'll be taking up House Bill 118, which we heard earlier today. So with that, many thanks to Sophia with House Records, Tom with LIO, thanks Jeff Stepp, our fearless committee aide, and at 3:54, we are adjourned.